5 p.m. Wednesday, time once again for American Hit Radio, 90.3 WHPC. Happy to be here. Thank you so much for joining us, as always. I'm your host, Tom Ryan, and with me, my lovely wife and co-host, Heidi Morales Ryan, as well.
I am here.
Of course you are.
Where else would I be?
How many of these shows have I done when you weren't here?
I don't know, one or two.
Maybe one or two. And that's usually because it's like the day before Thanksgiving or something.
Yes.
Other than that, you're always here. And I love that about you. It makes it fun to do the show because we get to basically interact. It's wonderful having somebody who is in the room physically with you when you're talking, because it makes me begin to think a little bit more about you, the listener at home, maybe, and the things that I'm saying. So let me get right down to what it is that I should be talking about for
what
that exact reason. Of course, on Wednesdays, we've been doing a countdown through two separate lists. One of them is the top 500 of the top 40, 500 albums that made the top 40 from 1964 until nowadays, I'll say that. And the second list is what we call the alternative top 40, another 500 albums that from 1964 to circa the present, where they never made the top 40, but they seem to have a tremendous amount of relevance despite the fact that they weren't particularly popular in their own time. It was those albums that really spawned this whole thing in the beginning, because I had a great interest in seeing how certain albums took a while to catch on. And we began with that, but you got to put in the popular albums too if you want to basically cover what the times felt like. It's a bit more
juxtaposition.
Yeah, it gives a more accurate picture of what's happening. So we've been working our way up from 1964, January of 64, where we started, and we are now all the way up to April of 1973. And the album we're going to cover today is from the alternative list, an album that did not reach the top 40. It didn't even really come particularly close to the top 40. It's an album called Catch a Fire. It is the international debut by Bob Marley and the Wailers. It was not their first album by any means. They had released a whole number of albums in Jamaica up until this point in time. But let's talk about how we got here. In the 60s, Jamaica was burning with passion and enthusiasm for music. Picking up on American influences that drifted over the late night radio airwaves, the island started developing its own unique culture that relied heavily on a rock steady backbeat that held the music together like a spine. Bob Marley, Bunny Wailer, and Peter Tosh grew up in the midst of this musical revolution and formed their own vocal group as young teenagers. By 1964, they had recorded a Jamaican number one hit entitled Simmer Down, but the local fame was interrupted when Marley moved to the U.S. to get some steady work. Returning to Jamaica a few years later, he adopted the Rastafarian faith and lifestyle, and he rejoined the Wailers, working with Lee Scratch Perry as their producer. The collaboration resulted in an album called Soul Rebels, an album that was received well enough to earn release in the UK, causing Marley to relocate there for a short while. As a London resident, Marley brought the Wailers over to work as support musicians for Johnny Nash, until Nash's career brought him to America, which left Marley and his bandmates stranded in England. They hadn't work, and they couldn't work if they wanted to, because you needed a special like work visa passes, and they weren't granted that. They didn't even have enough money to fly back to Jamaica.
Oh, no.
So they were really, truly stuck. Desperate for money, the Wailers approached Chris Blackwell, the head of Island Records, hoping to arrange for royalty payments on the work that they had done with Nash. Blackwell, meanwhile, needed new talent for his label and was desperately trying to figure out a way to unite the rebellious nature of rock and roll with the Jamaican sound that he had helped to propagate. One look at Marley and his cohorts with their dreadlocks and thoroughly foreign cultural manner, and Blackwell knew he found what he was looking for. He advanced them enough money to return to Jamaica and record an album. The band had plenty of material, and the recording sessions went smoothly, with Marley shortly returning to England carrying the finished product. Back to Chris Blackwell. Thinking from a commercial perspective, Blackwell felt that the bass heavy mix sounded too Jamaican, quote unquote, for a rock-weaned audience. So he remixed the tracks and even brought in session players to overdub guitar solos and organ parts. This tempered the album just enough for mass consumption. And Catch a Fire did indeed catch a fire, selling respectably to an audience that previously had been completely unfamiliar with the rhythmic push and pull of reggae music. Catch a Fire represented a small revolution in that case, but a revolution nonetheless. Suddenly, every rock and roll musician grew fascinated with the Jamaican reggae rhythm, and the Wailers were its authentic embodiment. The reggae rhythm stood the standard 4-4 rock and roll rhythm on its head, shifting accents while placing emphasis on the inside-out backbeat. Song topics veered from social politics like Concrete Jungle, Midnight Ravers, and racial issues, Slave Driver, 400 Years, to songs of love and sex like Stir It Up and Kinky Reggae. Even the simpler pop songs like Stop That Train and Baby We've Got a Date sounded inspirational. A decade of passion initially inspired by American pop music had come full circle. In the wake of Catch a Fire, American and European artists now looked to Jamaica for inspiration. A pretty amazingly cool turnaround that you can hear all of it happening literally on this very album. On the first track of the album that I'm going to play here now, it's a song called Concrete Jungle. You're going to hear the remixed version. I'm going to be playing the remixed version that was internationally released, and that's the version that we heard here in America in 1973. The bass is mixed more to a normal level that rock and roll musicians or listeners would be used to, as opposed to the bass heavy mix that they did in Jamaica. But more importantly, you're going to hear overdubbed organ and lead guitar parts to make it sound a bit more rock and roll. That's something that the Wailers didn't really do much on their own. So it's a rather interesting compromise, I suppose you could say, that they had this on the record. Eventually, the record became so popular, and it probably is, if you remove, say, greatest hits albums, like the Bob Marley Legend album, which a lot of people might say that is the most influential reggae album of all time. If you remove the greatest hits, though, I would say this album is probably the single most influential reggae album ever, because it is Bob Marley and the Wailers with Peter Tosh, Bunny Wailer, basically saying hello to the world. And because it became so popular and maybe the most important reggae album of all time, eventually the original version of the album was also released. So it would be easy now, if you were interested in reggae music, Bob Marley and the Wailers, you could probably find a CD copy or even like a digital release of either version of the album, or a way to get both. And it's interesting to hear both versions back to back. If we have spare time, if I would stop talking a little bit and we have time for a bonus track, I might even be able to throw one in. But as I said, playing from the remixed album as it was released in 1973, here is Concrete Jungle. Thank you.
You've got to do your best. Oh, yeah. No chains around my feet, but I'm not free. Oh, I know I am bound.
As you can hear there, if you were listening, there's that guitar break in the middle, which is sort of like a, in 1973, that was like a requisite part of a rock and roll song. You know, you'd have to get that middle solo bit where you'd go verse, chorus, bridge, you know, in some combination like that, but you would almost always have a solo. It's exactly why, you know, Eric Clapton was as popular as he was at this point in time. And in this instance, the player is Wayne Perkins. Perkins is an Alabama boy, actually. He was doing a lot of work at Muscle Shoals Sound Studio. He happened to be in England at around the time that Bob Marley delivered his original mix. And he was at Island Studios because he was doing work there on another album, which is exactly why he was asked to do the overdub. You might be familiar with Wayne Perkins, though, in terms of like other things that he had done in his time. He actually worked a lot with the Rolling Stones around the time that they were looking for a guitar player in 1974. He was actually set up to audition for the Rolling Stones. Eric Clapton helped him to get in an audition, and he actually played guitar for the band on the Black and Blue album before they hired Ron Wood. So you'll hear him on like three of the songs off of that album. That's him playing on Worried About You, because that was recorded from around that era. Mm-hmm. So yeah, he played with Leon Russell. So he's obviously a very tasty guitar player. I just don't know exactly how the Wailers may have felt about seeing their mix getting toyed with, but I guess they can't complain when the result was an international hit and a sudden acceptance of Jamaican music on an international level. They toured on this album in England and the United States, and there was those tours that basically made Americans aware of reggae for the first time. They were doing they were opening for people like Sly and the Family Stone.
Nice.
And I would even bet if that was the case that there were probably plenty of times where they would play and maybe Sly didn't even show up or didn't come out, or they were able to extend their set. So a lot of people would go home saying, well, at least we heard some really cool Jamaican band, you know, whatever that was. So that's the way that went down. Now, Marley wrote 7 of the 9 songs that are on the album. But this is pretty cool because this is a Wailers album in the true sense of the word, because it's, although it is Bob Marley and the Wailers, Peter Tosh plays a big role in the band around this time. And the next two songs sort of set that up. The first one is a Bob Marley song called Slave Driver, but it segues into a song written by Peter Tosh that is called 400 Years, which covers the exact same topicality. And Peter Tosh is not afraid of sounding a bit harsh or angry with his tone, and it really comes across, and it makes for a very powerful 1-2 punch when you hear Slave Driver at 400 Years back to back. So I'm not going to separate them. Here they are then. First up, Bob Marley's song Slave Driver, followed by Peter Tosh's 400 Years on 90.3 WHPC. I'm not inclined to ever get really political in the course of our show.
But
I mean, it does pay to at least recognize exactly what Peter Tosh means by 400 years. He's essentially saying that from the discovery of the Americas until the late 1800s, every black person who lived in the Americas was enslaved. It was essentially 400 years of slavery. And I don't think that you have to be quote unquote woke to say that or to realize it. To say that America was essentially built on the backs of slave labor.
Yes.
The entire industry of the United States, North America and South America and the islands, Jamaica itself, you know, a very large black population, but all of them enslaved. So, I mean, I know that some people get insulted when people talk about that, but it's not any manipulation of the facts.
Some people will try to manipulate the facts to say, oh, it's about the economy. Well, if the economy is based on slave labor, that's a problem.
Of course, it was about the economy. I mean, if it wasn't for the slave labor, things would have worked out very, very differently. There's no doubt about that. I don't see how that serves as a justification. I just think you've got to, one way or the other, you have to accept history for what it is and just accept the truth. And for that reason, you know, you whatever side you come down on, just, you know, that can't be denied. That part of it is true. And that's why I say you can hear a little bit of the anger in Peter Tosh's voice in the song 400 Years. He's a proud man, and you can, and it's quite obvious on that song. He wrote the next song as well. They put both of Peter Tosh's songs back to back on the album. And the next song is pretty much just a pleasant, straightforward pop hit called Stop That Train.
Stop that train, I'm leaving.
It's interesting. This is another thing that I find interesting about this record. Some of the organ sounds were recorded in Jamaica, but there were also others that were added in England when the tapes were brought over. And the organ, I would say, is much more germane, or if that's the right word, to the basic sound of the music than, say, the electric guitar. The electric guitar definitely brought in like a, almost like a rock and roll thing, but the organ sounds like a very much like a part of like what the Wailers were about. And the person who did the keyboard overdubs in England was a guy named Rabbit Bundrick. And anybody, if you're a Who fan, if you're a fan of Pete Townsend, you probably know who Rabbit Bundrick is. He played keyboards, I think, on all of Pete Townsend's solo work and on a whole bunch of Who albums. But before he was doing that, he was a band member for Johnny Nash's band, which is to say that he was on tour with Bob Marley and the Wailers because the Wailers were playing with Johnny Nash when they were on tour. So they knew Rabbit Bundrick. In fact, they even all roomed together when they were on tour. Bundrick, Marley, and Tosh, I believe, like stayed in the same room while they were touring.
Oh, nice.
So it was only natural that if they were going to bring in a keyboardist, that it was somebody who they were familiar with. So it's Bundrick who came in to do that work. And it's funny to think that later on, he ended up playing for bands like Free for a while and then became pretty crucial to Pete Townsend's work from about 1976, 1977 on. Just funny to think of that he had that connection in the past. But we were talking about Wayne Perkins and overdubbing guitar parts on the album. Well, you're going to hear a slide guitar on this next song called Baby We've Got a Date, Rocket Baby. And that is Wayne Perkins playing the slide guitar on the song written by Bob Marley. It's the last song on side one of the Catch a Fire album.
I'll meet you at your
This is as good a time as any, I guess, to talk about the rhythm that, you know, that really kind of changed.
It's very unique.
The drumming is something to behold. It's very, very, I have a real difficult time. I mean, either you do it or you don't. I think that the players that I know that play really, really good reggae rhythms are not particularly great at turning it around and playing standard American rhythms. And on the other hand, I can speak for myself when to say, if I am asked to play anything which is Jamaican, I've got to work hard in the beginning to basically turn my head around to that sort of a feel.
Right.
Because it's not just the fact that the foot is playing on the accent where you normally would have a snare hit. Although that is a big part of it. You've got to basically turn things around where you put everything to the boom, tick, boom, tick, tick, boom, tick, like that. And you've got to do that with your foot, usually, not just your hand. So that's odd. But the other thing is that the drums are usually tuned very differently. You heard at the very beginning of that very high-pitched tom. And it's sort of a thing that exists almost exclusively on reggae records. And it also causes them to basically get to the point where they have like really cool fills that are offbeat. You don't really necessarily crash on the downbeat very often in Jamaican rhythms. And it makes for a really interesting feel. And it's why a lot of people, you know, who try to do it, it sort of comes off half-assed. If you listen to like Eric Clapton's version of "I Shot the Sheriff," it really was, that band was like struggling to try to imitate it. You know, it's funny if you play that back to back with Marley's original. And the players here, you gotta give credit to them in particular. The drummer is Carlton Barrett was his name. Just a fabulous reggae drummer. And it's his brother, Aston Barrett, Aston Family Man Barrett, who played bass for the Wailers. And it's that the way that you get like an Everly Brothers thing happening with harmony, you've got that sort of the same thing happening with a bass player and a drummer being brothers. They really fall together.
Yeah. And, they know each other.
There's a real instinctive thing about what they're doing. And they are like, they're up there. Robbie Shakespeare does appear in this album, one of the most famous of bass players, you know, along with Sly Dunbar on drums. They're maybe the most famous rhythm section of all from Jamaica. But you got to give the Barrett brothers their due. They're right up there with them. And this next song, I think, takes it a step further, where you can hear killer Jamaican rhythms. And again, more overdubbed guitar, this time a wah-wah. So it's interesting that the guitar, Wayne Perkins basically played three completely different styles of guitar on the three songs that he appears on. And it's maybe the most famous song on the album. It's called "Steer It Up."
Thank you.
sexy reggae song.
Ooh, kinky reggae.
There, by Bob Marley. It's a shame that, you know, they were touring on this album in England and in the United States, and they were getting popular, but Bunny Wailer had a problem with it, a big problem with it. He had a really strict Ital diet, which is a Rasta diet.
Uh-huh.
And Ital is based on the word vital, the English word vital. Mm-hmm. But like a lot of Rastafarian language, words in the Rastafarian language, they refer to I a lot, I and I, Ital. It makes more sense because it basically is a reference to yourself and ties you to nature and to other people. And the diet meant that you had to eat food that was natural without additives or any preservatives. And it was driving Bunny crazy because he couldn't find what he wanted. He felt like he was going to be starving to death. So he essentially left the band to stay in England. They recorded one more album with him. And then he was gone. And then Peter Tosh was gone soon after that. And from that point forward, after the next album, which was released later in 1973, and we will cover it in time, it would then become Bob Marley's band. Well, we've got two more tracks to play. I had a lot of fun doing this. I hope you enjoyed it as well. The songs remaining are called No More Trouble and Midnight Ravers. Thanks once again for listening. We will be back for our Friday series, of course, on the Great American Songbook, and then with a brand new album again on Wednesday next week. So thanks for listening, folks, and we'll see you on Friday or Wednesday. Bye-bye. We don't need no.